Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the World of Ink Network. Founded in 2011 by Virginia Grenier and Marcia Casper Cook, their vision was to start a radio show that helped authors reach their dreams. The World of Ink Network has a wonderful group of hosts who are also authors and dedicated to delivering shows to entertain and inspire listeners. The World of Ink Network shares resources that introduce tips, products, and services to help strengthen, support, and challenge those who love writing and the written word. Their hope is to bring not only authors, illustrators, and publishers together, but screenwriters, directors, and producers. New to the network will be a variety of special shows bringing not only entertainment but informative discussions on timely subjects. To learn more about us, go to www.worldofinknetwork.com or visit us on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thank you for your support and enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the special Family Matters show today about a fresh approach to the issue of bullying. Gosh, I can't even talk at all. This is your host, Virginia S. Grenier and Tracy McDonald. How are you, Tracy?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I can't even speak today. I've been in meetings all day, so now I'm getting tongue-tied, of course, because we're live on the air. So really quickly, before we jump into today's show, I just wanted to go over what we have here at Blog Talk Radio, because it's the summer, and as everybody knows, we tend to do less shows during the summertime because a lot of our hosts go on vacation. So we do have coming up on Tuesday next week, August 4th at, I'm trying to do math in my head, 5 p.m. Eastern time. Is going to be best-selling author Mary McNair, and it looks like she'll be talking about her Butternut Lake trilogy that will be hosted by Marcia Casper Cook. So that will be a fun show to come and listen in on, especially if you are a writer. She'll also be reading some of her books as well on the show. They'll be talking about audiobooks and how that's starting to take over as another venue that's getting more popular within the publishing industry, and just a few other things as well. So that will be on Tuesday, August 4th at 5 p.m. Eastern. And then we also have another songwriting special that Marcia Casper Cook will be hosting as well. That one will be on, that one was already done. That was our, it popped up and I don't know why. That was actually our featured show on the World of Ink Network here on Blog Talk Radio. So definitely tune in to that one. That'll be a good one. I'm sorry. So on August 6th will be a sexy romance show hosted by Marcia Casper Cook and Elizabeth Black. So if you are into romance, especially the more exotic and erotic romance, you want to tune into that show on August 6th, and that will be at 4 p.m. Eastern. And then we also have Poetry with Eleanor Park and Jack Rimmick, and that will be on August 13th at 6 p.m. Eastern time. So that's another show that's coming up. So that's what we have planned here at Blog Talk Radio currently. And today our special guest was Fawn Irison Nelson from Here Are My Heart Books. However, it looks like she has not called in. I don't know if she's having problems, because I know we were having, just right before the show, some technical problems with getting in and hearing each other. So we'll wait to see if she'll call in. But I know, Tracy, did you get a chance to kind of look a little bit around on today's topic and anything interesting you want to share while we hopefully see if Fawn shows up?
I did. In fact, I went and did a little bit of research on her company, Here My Heart Books. They are based out of Saskatchewan, Canada, and they host authors that specifically help not only the people who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and other kinds of mental and behavioral issues, but the people who help deal with them as well. There was a couple of the books that are available and that are being launched this year that I was interested in. There's one called straight up. It's 13 mm-hmm. different gang members who talk about their experience in gangs, how they got involved, and what the price was and why it's not a good idea for kids. I worked with a group of kids that were gang members that were in a foster care program. So I was really interested in being able to get a hold of that. It's called Straight, S-T-R, the number 8, and T, Straight Up Gang Members.
That sounds like there's a good book. And I know that, honestly, that's been a growing problem, especially those who live in the inner cities, you know, in urban-type communities. It's becoming more and more of a problem. You know, kids joining gangs,
yeah.
They want to feel like they belong to something. So that's great. I'm glad to hear about it.
Especially where we've got a lot of kids who they don't have strong families, and so they look to gangs to take the place of their families.
Yeah.
It's kind of a pretty serious problem that we're going through right now. And to have these gang members speaking up and giving back to kids and trying to get them away from that kind of situation where they've been through it and they know what the difficulties and the consequences of those kinds of decisions are. I think it's be an interesting book to read, if not be able to do something with.
No, I definitely, I would love to hear a little bit about when you were working with kids that were, you know, in that type of crisis situation. Is there any tips that you can share with parents about that, you know, to help them that might be battling a scenario like that, or even teachers?
Most of the kids that we dealt with in the foster care program were in the foster care program because they had gone as far as to break some pretty major laws. They were beyond the point where you could stop them from becoming gang members. They were in gangs. A lot of them were from Northern Utah, the Ogden area especially, and they were in some mm-hmm. pretty serious trouble at that point. They were mules for drug dealers. They had been convicted of assault. Some of them had actually been involved in drive-by shootings. We had a kid that plotted to kill his girlfriend, and the guy that he hired to do it turned him in. So we had some different interesting, but most of these kids came from, once again, backgrounds where they didn't have a family. So the gang on the street became their family.
Right.
One of the kids that we had a lot of success with, his father was an OTR, over the road truck driver,
mm-hmm.
and his mother was in prison. So his father would leave him cash on the kitchen table. He was 15 years old. His father would leave him cash on the kitchen table, and then he would go on these long haul runs. And this poor kid was just left to take care of himself, get himself to school, buy the groceries, cook his own food, and take care of himself wholly and completely on his own. He didn't have anybody else. He didn't have a family. He didn't have anyone taking care of him. So, of course, he mm-hmm. went and found other kids who were in that same type of a situation where they didn't have anybody strong at home. They didn't have parents. They didn't have anything that they could look to or count on. And so they grouped together, and they found what are called OGs, original gangsters, who are sometimes in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, who have been running these groups of kids on the street for decades. And they pretty much get everything they want, and they pretty much do everything for these older guys.
Wow.
And
that's the most
common situation that we found.
Yeah, and that's that. And, you know, and from growing up in the L.A. area and definitely through the 90s when gangs were becoming a huge problem at that time in that part of California, I know one of the big thing too, is when you know, even if the parents were home, if they were, you know, had problems with, you know, addicts with drinking or drugs or whatnot, that a lot of those kids tended to join gangs because their parents basically, they were taking on the adult role, taking care of their parents versus being kids themselves. And that's the one thing I saw at least in my schools growing up and living in the LA area, was kids who were kind of forced to become the adult of the home or were treated like an adult versus a teen, that they tended to band together into those kind of groups because they want to be a kid. They want to feel like they can rely on somebody and have somebody guide them, teach them, versus all of a sudden be considered an instant adult and try and figure it out on their own.
Yeah, and that's what we found too. A lot of these kids, they don't have adult role models because they are taking care of the adults in their life, drinking problems, problems with drug addiction, problems with domestic violence, parents who just aren't involved in the kids' lives. They're falling apart and the kids are taking care of the adults instead. And so they're searching for guidance, for acceptance, mm-hmm. for someone who thinks that they're amazing, and they can get that from these people on the street that are telling them that there isn't anything they can't do, that they'll take care of them and they'll protect them, because that's what the kids want. That's what kids really want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I hear you. What else did you find with the Hear My Heart books that also, because you said you found quite a few that you thought were pretty interesting and that you wanted to
Offer it? There was another one that was written by a woman called Wall of Tears, and it is the story of a young woman who's dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, which is also another one of those disorders that is very close to me because my son, who is 16 years old, he was adopted from Western Africa, and he suffered quite a bit of post-traumatic stress disorder when we took him out of Africa. The country that he's from is, they are not currently, but at the time that we adopted him, they were involved in a number of different civil war issues. Anyone who's familiar with The Blood Diamonds, the movie by Leonardo DiCaprio, that is the country that he is from. And those are the experiences that he had with people whose hands were cut off digging for diamonds. Armed soldiers who came through and at gunpoint forced people to dig for diamonds. He was in a Christian organization that had him in an orphanage. But an orphanage in Western Africa is basically just an empty building. There were over 40 children in the orphanage where he was. They had two women that took care of all 40 of those children. Basically, the children just wandered. And when the soldiers showed up, the women would gather them together and they'd hide in the jungle and they would wait for the soldiers to go through, and they would set fire to buildings with people inside them. They would round people up and shoot them. We took him to some post-traumatic stress disorder therapy when he was about 4 or 5 years old, and he acted out some of the things that he'd seen, people knifed, people killed. He did an activity where he took a dollhouse and he filled the dollhouse with all of the dolls in the room. And then he emptied out the dolls and he filled it with the G.I. Joe figurines. And then he killed all of the soldiers and buried them all around the dollhouse by taping them to the floor. And when I asked his therapist what he was doing, she told me he was acting out what he had seen happen. All of the children were taken out. The soldiers killed each other, and then they buried them around the outside of his home. So those are the kind of things that he had gone through, and we experienced with him when he was young, especially night terrors, where he was awake, but he would have waking nightmares of some of the things that happened to him while he was in Africa. The very first time we took him to see fireworks on the 4th of July, he curled into a ball on the sidewalk and started to cry, because in his mind, that was his country being bombed. That was not a celebration. Yeah. It was not fun. It was frightening for him.
Right. Yeah.
So this book is called Wall of Tears. And it is the story of a young woman who is experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder. And it talks about some of the things that trigger her, some of the nightmarish waking terrors that people with post-traumatic stress disorder go through, and that children actually experience this kind of behavior when they have been through things that are traumatic when they're very young and aren't taught how to handle those kinds of things. That's the reality of their world, things that are violent and traumatic.
And I think sometimes, you know, as adults, we think, you know, when people hear, you know, post-traumatic stress, and, you know, we think of soldiers, you know, people who are out in the, or like, you know, officers who are, you know, again, like urban type areas versus, you know, obviously like Southern Utah and St. George, because they don't have like shootouts that often. Those kind of things. That's why I think a lot of people think of PTSD. But, you know, I know people, kids can get it. And I mean, obviously your son was in a very traumatic scenario. So totally not surprised, because, you know, he was in a war zone growing up as a little boy. But, you know, I know kids can get it, you know, from simple things too, just from, you know, verbal abuse and being in an abusive home, or even if they're not being abused by their parents, watching their dad abuse the mom, or maybe the parents abusing a different sibling, or, you know, that kind of stuff can cause that same kind of thing. And so I, you know, it's great that, you know, those companies reaching out and groups and organizations that are trying to help those kids in crisis and deal with those kinds of things. Because I'm sure your experiences,
that's one of the things that I found interesting about this particular company is they aren't reaching out to your generic, normal American families. They're reaching out to people who are suffering from kind of abnormal or out of normal society trauma and experiences that just most everyday kids don't have. And because of that, they are able to teach not only the people who are involved in those family type situations, but the people who are hired to deal with those kind of things too.
And it looks like Fawn still, I was going to just let our listeners know, it looks like Fawn won't be able to join us today. Something's going on where she's not able to call into our studio, but Tracy and I will talk about some of this stuff because this is good information and Tracy's still alive. So go ahead, Tracy, what else are you going to say?
Well, one of the things that I discovered when I was trying to help my son with, I took him to a play therapist because he was very young, and that's a good place to start for parents and teachers, social workers, anybody like that who can get a child below the age of seven. If you can get to them below the age of seven, often you can heal some of these disorders, but it has to be taken care of while their brains are still pretty pliable and where they can be helped. So he was 4 years old, and I took him to a play therapist who basically allowed him to talk about what had happened to him without using words. He did not speak English, and so actually talking isn't something that children do very well. So a play therapist, if you're experiencing anything with adopted children who might have come from neglectful families or families in situations where there was a mother or a father or a caretaker of any kind who neglected them and had drug issues or alcoholic issues. If you're having behavioral problems or they're experiencing these kinds of things, night terrors especially are one of the very first things that give away that a kid is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Things that seem fairly normal to you and have a large emotional impact on the child can give away that this child is actually seeing and experiencing something different than you are. One of the first things that happened with Josh was we were waiting at a bus stop and a truck, a box truck that hauls around like furniture to deliver, pulled up in the streets in front of the bus stop, and he absolutely came unglued. He started shaking and crying. He went and hid behind a building. He wouldn't come anywhere near the bus stop until the truck left. And I had no idea. I had no idea what was going on. I had no idea why he had that reaction. And I took him to therapy, and he played, acted out some of this kind of thing. And one of the things he did was he took a truck and he loaded the truck with soldier dolls once again and drove the truck around, and then the soldier dolls would get out and kill everything that they could find. And in play therapy, a lot of times it was, you know, plastic bugs or dolls, just different things that he would use to represent people. And I did a little bit of research into some of the things that was going on in Sierra Leone, and I discovered that a lot of times the soldiers showed up in these villages in these trucks, and they would get out, and then they would terrorize the village, and then they would get back in the truck and drive off. So
honestly, I from some of the documentary type stuff I've seen and books I've read about that area too, I know they would also round up a lot of the young boys too to recruit. I don't want to say recruit. I mean, they called it recruiting, but basically force them to join and become whatever soldier group they were. So I could totally see, you know, a young boy who came from there freaking out for sure.
They would gather these kids up and arm them. Actually, they would give them Uzis or automatic weapons,
right, and make them go shoot people. I know a lot of times with kids and trying to identify if they're going through, you know, some type of dramatic situation, you know, be it, you know, what your son went through, sexual abuse, whatever, I love TV, but a lot of TV always shows, like, when the kids go to the therapist, or, you know, what alerts the parents to this problem is, you know, they drew like this really bad picture in school, or in their room at 3 years old, drawing this like really bad picture. And I'm like, but sometimes kids don't do that. So what other things can parents, you know, maybe to help them be a little bit more self-aware, or caregivers and teachers be a little bit more self-aware? Because I think sometimes they're waiting to either see the kids acted out, you know, in a bully situation to other kids on the, you know, that are around them at school on the playground, or they're going to like draw these pictures. But I know, you know, like your son, your first example wasn't that way with him. So what kind of things should people be attuned?
The artwork is actually a way that therapists can try to get kids to express themselves. But kids don't normally express themselves that way right off the bat. First of all, they know that if they draw pictures, that's going to give away something. They're very secretive. They don't give away because they're trying to hide. They're hiding themselves from these kinds of terrors. Mm-hmm. And letting them out in any way, shape, or form makes it even scarier. One of the things I worked with my son was the concept that monsters live in the dark, that you have to bring the monsters out of the dark in order for them to go away, because they can't live outside of the dark. But in order to recognize that your child is having some sort of an experience that is beyond comprehensible normal, you have to be much more aware of their everyday behavior. Josh had some starvation issues because he didn't get the kind of food he needs. Oftentimes neglected children in homes where drugs and alcohol are more important than nutrition will be obsessed with food. They'll put it in their pockets. They'll hide it in their personal things. They'll put it in their backpacks. They'll hide it anywhere that they can figure out, and they'll try to get it from other kids. So in a school type of a situation, you can see that they're going through some sort of trauma based on the food. How much do they eat? Do they pack it as if they're not going to get any more? Will they pick it up and carry it around for long periods of time? Because this may be the only food that they're going to get. And it doesn't look anything like, you know, it just looks like a little kid playing with his food. But if you know what to look for, then you can tell when they're stashing or hoarding food, when they're obsessed with some kind of food, when it's to the point where Josh would eat from garbage cans.
Wow.
And the kids thought it was really, really funny that he would eat from the garbage cans. But in the world that he came from, it was beyond his comprehension that they would throw food away because the people where he lived were starving. They ate from the streets. He would climb trees and eat the bugs out of the trees.
Wow.
Because that's something that they did in his country when they were starving. Mm-hmm. So if you have a little bit of background on the child, if you're familiar with the neighborhood, if you're familiar with the parents' situation, if you can get any kind of information on what is normal in their home or normal in their neighborhood, then you can see a lot of times that behaviors that they seem a little off, but it, you know, a little boy who climbs a tree and eats bugs isn't really that much off of a little boy who climbs a tree and plays with bugs.
Right.
So you have to know, first of all, that you're looking for something. And second of all, you have to know what's normal in your world and normal in theirs, and then compare those two things side by side in order to be able to see that some things are not, they're not the way they're supposed to be. My son is 16 years old now, and we still have problems with him being able to tell the difference between being full and being hungry. Mm-hmm. He can't tell the difference. He's either full or he's hungry. There's nothing in between.
Right. Boy, too. So I'm sure that doesn't help because they grow like weeds.
Yeah, it does not help that he's 16. He wants
like,
to be constantly part of that.
Yeah. Yeah, because I'm like, I'm thinking of my 9-year-old who grew up in the U.S. I'm like, he ate all the time anyways at 16. But I get it. I still get it. I mean, obviously, there's still differences between a normal 16-year-old boy who consumes your whole entire pantry versus someone who came from a starving background.
and then you also have to take a look at, you know, circumstances. He went from being 175 pounds to 200 pounds in 3 months.
Oh, wow.
That's a significant weight gain in a very, very short period of time. Now, if he'd have grown 6 inches in that period of time, that would not be that significant of a weight gain, but he didn't. He grew about an inch, and that's it. So we got to the point where he was having problems with stretch marks. He was becoming more and more lethargic. It was obvious that the amount of food that he was consuming and what was healthy for him were not the same thing.
We're not in line.
So I love that you
bring that up because I know, which I know we haven't gotten to the bully part yet, but with, you know, they always talk about childhood obesity. And I think there's a lot of kids who, you know, instead of going out and playing or whatever, because I've seen this with my own kids as they've grown up that, you know, if they're not active and running around and like, and when I mean active, like where their brain's engaged in what's going on around them, that they tend to get bored, and out of boredom, a lot of kids eat where parents just think, oh, well, they're just eating because they're going through a growth spurt. And that's where you see those lethargic type things where you start realizing, you know, the balance isn't there. So even like with normal kids, that can be an issue because they're not being engaged. So therefore they are falling into a crisis situation because they're not engaging their mind. So they're becoming lackluster about life.
Yeah. And you can tell when a child is stimulating themselves with food, if they're placid in general, they would prefer television or video games or even books. My son is, He loves books, but he wants to sit and read and eat all of the time. And he doesn't read books that are on his grade level. He reads books that are below his grade level where he can skim through them and not have to challenge his mind. And he stimulates himself with the food. So anytime you're using food to stimulate yourself, it doesn't even have to be in an exercise type of a situation. You have to stimulate your mind and your body together. And you have to do it in a way that doesn't mean that you're consuming calories while you do it. The very first instance that I had with him was we were on an Easter egg hunt, and he took all of the hard-boiled Easter eggs, and he ate them all 25 of the ones that he gathered. And he made himself sick, and he threw up.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went right back and started gathering up more eggs. And once again, that's extreme behavior. But when you see a child that doesn't go to those extremes, but still has a tendency to stimulate themselves in an activity type of a situation where their bodies are engaged but their minds are not, they will mm-hmm. stimulate themselves with food. And then it can cause obesity problems. And starvation is one of those things that there are a lot of kids in lower income families and families where there's one parent or an addicted parent where food is sometimes the only stimulation they have.
Yeah, so they'll do the same thing, eat a lot. And I do know about that because I lived in low-income housing when I was a kid, and I used to see a lot more. And it's funny because everyday people, now that, you know, I'm grown up and an adult, you know, so I'm in the middle class now from where I was when I was a kid. But I hear a lot of middle class or upper class who make the comment like, you know, it's amazing that people who are on social services, getting welfare, this and that, that, you know, a lot of them tend to be heavy. And it's like because mm-hmm. their only stimulus is the food. And even if they are getting food stamps and they're eating healthy food, they're still consuming more of it than they should, which is still putting weight on. But yeah, unfortunately, the middle class and upper class don't understand that. And they see that as, you know, basically they're sitting around being lazy and, you know, they're obviously not that bad off if they're able to, you know, eat all this food and whatever. Because I think a lot of times people think of those scenarios that everybody should be like skinny because they're not getting the food they need versus that's where they spend their money. If it's not on drugs and alcohol and cigarettes, it's on food to stimulate themselves.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that we really don't understand a lot of times about lower income level families or families that struggle with behavioral mm-hmm. issues because of drug and alcohol abuse is that food a lot of time represents something solid, something real, and something that feels good because it tastes good. And so therefore it is good. Anything that tastes good, anything that's sweet, anything that gives them pleasure is good. And their children, right, they don't have people who are saying to them, eat an apple, it's good for you. They have people who are saying, just go eat something. Be bored, don't do anything, stay out of my way and eat something. And as a society in general, we love each other with food. We've done it our entire lives. Someone passes away, we bring food. Someone has a birthday, we bring food. Someone has something to celebrate, we get food. Food is what we do to love each other, and especially these children who are in difficult home situations, love and food are the same thing.
Yeah, it is. It's that's why in the U.S. it's known as a comfort. Food is a always says like food's comfort, you know, it's a comfort food.
Yep.
And it's very true. And when you think about it, too, I mean, the first thing everything says when they go to help low-income people, what is it? Well, let's do a food drive. Let's do a soup kitchen.
Uh-huh.
It's food. Food-driven.
Yeah, let's provide food and you'll be okay. You won't have any other problems in your life as long as we can provide you with enough food.
Yeah.
But the truth is that we're actually neglecting.
Yeah, other needs. Not saying that there are people who need food because they can't afford food. Definitely those people need food, but sometimes we don't realize that not everybody who's in the lower class needs food. There might be other needs that need to be met as well. Which, you know, talking about all this and kids who go through this, and this is the one thing, and I've always been like the devil's advocate when it comes to the bully subject with kids because, you and I both live, you know, out in the Southern Utah area. And so our kids go to the same, you know, a lot of the same schools or have gone to the same schools. And as you know, in our schools, they have like, you know, this is the non-bully zone, you know, posters up everywhere,
right.
Which I always roll my eyes at when I walk into the school because I just crack up and think that's absolutely hilarious. And the reason why I say that is because a lot of the times kids who bully, it's because they are kids who are in crisis. And so
mm-hmm.
now instead of trying to recognize that and help those kids, like I remember happening when we were growing up as children. Now we're punishing all the kids in the school and treating them all the same. Because even if like one kid is the bully and knows the antagonist and the other one's just, you know, unfortunately the victim of the antagonist, they both
uh-huh.
get in trouble. And it's like,
yeah,
okay, there's more to this than that. Or maybe the kid who's getting bullied is from a crisis situation, which is the other way of bullying goes, is, you know, kids who come from the higher and middle class society picks on mm-hmm. the child who doesn't, yep. you know, like you're saying, you know, maybe they're hoarding food and they think they're funny, and so they start picking on them. So I love that bullying's become such a focus in our society and within the schools and community. But at the same time, I wonder, are we not recognizing what bullying really is? Because, I mean, for example, and I wish Fawn was here because she actually wrote her book, Spots, Dots, and the Knots, which I've read.
Mm-hmm.
And I posted up, you know, basically what the story is about, which it teaches kids about human rights. It reinforces, you know, who we all are and who we are meant to be. You know, it builds dialogue.
You avoid shame and blame.
Yeah, to avoid shame and blame, you know, how to, you know, provide support to the bully. And this is what I like. This book actually supports, which is why I just talked about it. It provides support to the bully, the victim, and the bystander. No, it addresses why those kids to look for, you know, why they're in those specific roles. Not just,
right.
Well, you guys are all, you know, you all are to blame because you're bullying and that's just not okay. And, you know, go to see the principal or, you know, whatever. And then also the other thing too about her book is, you know, it talks about, you know, how we all have choices, you know, to how we want to deal with our anger, how we want to deal with our unhappiness, how we want to include, you know, inclusion of other people around us and how to grow friendships. And I love the fact that it's the first time I've seen a book on the subject bullying that really addresses what I remember growing up as a kid. You know, I mean, kids are going to be kids. I mean, you cannot, I love the fact that schools want kids to not bully each other, but we don't live in utopia and a utopian society. I mean, if we can't get along with each other as a country or even each other within our own nation, state to state, and government, you know, state government to state government, city government to city government, how in the heck can we expect that of our kids, right?
Yeah. Well, and that's the part that I really liked about it, too. It's not saying these are the bullies and the bullies are bad and these are the kids that are being picked on and this is what we do to help the kids that are being picked on. It shows roles. It shows reasons that people find themselves in the roles, and then it gives them the power to get themselves out of those roles and makes them responsible for the choices to either remain in the role or to get out. You're not mm-hmm. labeled as a bully. You're not labeled as a victim. You're not labeled as someone who did nothing. You're told you're in this situation because of these choices, and this is how you choose something else. And I think kids mm-hmm. especially want that kind of power. They don't want to feel like they're stuck being what the adults label them. They want the power to choose where they want to be and how they want to handle it. That was my favorite part about it. I thought it was it was just inspirational to see these kids become powerful in their own lives instead of victims mm-hmm. that had to be hovered over by the adults that were around them.
Yeah, because I mean, I remember when I was in high school, and primarily in high school, you see this a lot. Unfortunately, you see it more in high school than, and I know it's starting to filter into the elementary schools nowadays, but, you know, you have, you know, the class clown. Everybody has heard that term, you know, oh, you know, I was a mm-hmm. class clown, or yeah. my friend was a class clown, or, you know, I hated the class clown when I was in school, whatever. And I remember because that label, and those labels got put on people, and, you know, that was the one thing, and I've just recently connected with quite a few of my old high school friends and even people that I remember in high school that, you know, I only had classes with them. So I wouldn't have, and I don't want to make them feel like they're not my friend now, but, you know, back then I would not have, you know, I would be like, oh, there's somebody I know, you know, but I didn't really hang out. And I'd go from like literally click to click, you know, from label to label. And
right.
one of my old friends from high school made a comment. She's like, you know, it was thinking back on school, you never, even though you were in track, you weren't really a jock, and your best friend was a cheerleader, but you really weren't, you know, you weren't a cheerleader, and you weren't this, you weren't that. You kind of hung out and talked to everybody. And I think back to that because I looked at people for who they were, I wasn't looking for the labels, which is what we do as a society. You know, we label things
yeah.
because we feel like that makes it makes everything better versus individually assessing each person.
And we feel like we have that power and that control when we can herd everybody into a group that we can, you know, put a label on and say, okay, now I know who you are. I know how you're going to act. I know what to expect from you because I'm going to stick you over here with all these other people and I'm going to label you. And that way I'm in control. Whereas really being in control is being able to make your own choices based on the relationship that you have with that person or the relationship that you want with that person. And they don't need a label or a group in order for you to control them. You control yourself. And the truth to being able to beat bullying in society, in government, in a school type of a situation, is teaching kids self-control, showing us the things that are alike about each of us and not different. That was also one of the things that I really, really liked about dots, spots, and the knots. You can be who you are, and that's okay. And you can let other people be who they are, and that's okay too. We don't have to be alike. We don't have to think alike. We don't have to want the same things. We can find things that we have in common because we all have something in common. And to give that kind of power to kids in situations that are social makes it so that in any situation in their life, they can find what it is that they want out of the situation instead of being stuffed into a category or given a label and told that they're never going to make their dreams come true or they're never going to be who they're supposed to be.
Yeah, and it's true because, I mean, going back to what I was talking about when I was in school, when my friend made this comment over social media when we were talking on Facebook and just kind of reminiscing and when the call made up and I, you know, just finished reading this book, I started realizing, wow, you know, that's what it's, and I mean, I just naturally did that as a kid. I really did, but I never felt labeled. So therefore, going back to the class clown, if I had been labeled as a class clown and that's how everybody saw me in school, I think it would have made me act that way more, even if that's really not who I was, just because that.
Yeah.
And that's the thing I think that happens when you label a kid as a bully, then all of a sudden they feel like, well, that's who I am. That's how I'm identified. So I'm going to do as much as I can to personify that label. And
again,
that's what I love about this book is it's teaching people, it's basically teaching kids, you know, inner empowerment and to instead of using outward stimuli to feel empowered, to learn to look inward and do it in an introspective way to empower themselves, which is a really hard thing.
It teaches them to get to know themselves. It teaches them to be aware of who they are and what they want instead of looking around and having everybody else give that kind of information to him. One of the things that you find, especially with kids who are in abusive situations, is that they very much take on a victim type of a role because they don't have and they don't understand anything else. Children are vulnerable, and they know it. They know that they are vulnerable to bigger, stronger, more powerful people. And so when the bigger, stronger, more powerful people are doing these horrible things to them, they become a victim. And then they see themselves as a victim for the rest of their lives, even when they're in the bigger, stronger, more powerful roles. I had to do this. I had to bully this kid because I don't have any other choices. This is who I am. This is who they labeled me. I don't have any other skills. Nobody taught me anything else. Because this is who they told me I was, and so I became that person. And these kids in vulnerable situations are especially susceptible to watching and going, oh, yep, that's who I am. And they'll do it a lot of times based on their size, based on the difference between a big kid and a little kid, or a smart kid and that kid who struggles. Things that are normal with just human behavior, but as little kids, you see it as they see things that make them different instead of the things that make them the same.
Right. Yeah, it's true. Well, or even they look at things, because I've seen sometimes where, you know, if a specific you know, it doesn't even have to be ethnicity, just a specific, you know, majority of a type of group is more, you know, if there's more girls versus, you know, boys, the girls are going to pick on the guys. You know, if you have more Latinos versus, you know, Caucasians and African Americans, the Latinos tend to dominate, or vice versa. You know, I've been to schools where it's primarily Caucasian, and we'll have like a few kids from other minorities, and all of a sudden, you know, they're like feeling, you know, like they're on the outside and victims. And any time like someone who was Caucasian made a comment to someone who was Asian or Latino or African American, it was taken as, you know, even if it was like a joking, just passing, just kind of, you know, tease, as flat out bullying, because they're, you know, they're in the smaller population. So, you know, I know it can happen that way too. It, you know, where you gang up in groups, you know, if my group's bigger than your group, we're going to, you know, take on a whatever, you know.
Well, and once again, that's power, that I am better off when I am in a group that's just like me. Yeah. So if I can gather together with other people who are just like me, and then I can be irritated or annoyed about something, then I can get everybody else irritated and annoyed about the same thing. And then you've got a group of kids who've all been labeled the same way, and now they're just perpetuating the label. Because I'm a bully, well, so are you. Well, so you don't want to be a victim, you can be a bully. This is one of the struggles that my 16-year-old had when he was probably second, third, fourth, fifth grade. He was a bully. He's a big kid. He's a big black kid in a white community. And he oftentimes got what he wanted through sheer force. Well, he learned to get what he wants through sheer force from growing up in a country where everybody was the same color, but the men who had the biggest guns had the most power.
Right.
So he gets labeled as a bully because he's bigger and he has more power and he's different than all the other kids. And so he takes that label on and then he perpetuates it. I said to him one time that he needed to take care that he was gentle with people because he could be scary sometimes. And he took that on. And he decided that that meant when he wanted to get what he wanted, he needed to be scary. And I told him, I said, there are going to be people who are going to be afraid to poke the bear. That was the reference I gave him. So if you want to make friends with people, you have to make it so they're not afraid to poke the bear. So he actually went around the elementary school. And he would demand food from these other kids. And if they would tell him no, he'd get up in their faces and he'd say, you don't want to poke this bear.
I know.
From what I tried to teach him, he used it as the label that made it so he was more powerful and could get what he wanted. And it takes It takes a lot of time.
And that's the other thing, too, because I know sometimes, you know, and I've experienced this with my own children, you know, where we try to give examples, and because of that, they're like, you in the same process, you give them the information that something they do gives them power. So it goes backfires on you. And it is, it's hard to teach. I mean, even as adults, we have a hard time learning to empower ourselves internally from, you know, instead of from external, you know, forces. So I'm just curious, you know, in that situation with your son, because I know him, you know, how did you change that around to where he wasn't taking something, of course, now using it to empower himself even more into a label versus, you know, becoming more of a kind, caring kid?
What we did with him as far as bullying was concerned at the school was when he interacted with people that way and they would shy away from him, they would become afraid of him. And he was proud of the fact that they would become afraid of him. And part of making him responsible for the choice that he made to wear that label was also to make him responsible for having to humble himself in situations where he scared people or he threatened people. So if I got reports from the elementary school that he was acting like that and he was pushing kids around and he was threatening kids, I would go in to the elementary school and I would have him sit down with these kids that he had scared, and he would talk to them, and he would tell them why he was doing what he was doing. And a lot of times he wouldn't talk. He would sit stern-faced with his arms crossed and refuse to talk. And I would tell them a little bit of his story, why food was so important to him, what he had been through, and the kind of things that he had seen and why he acted the way that they acted. And then they started asking him questions. They wanted to know what Africa was like. They wanted to know what he remembered. They wanted to know if he still spoke the same language. And when they were interested in him as an individual, as a person, not as the bully that scared them, he could open up to them. And he could make them laugh. And he could talk to them and feel like they were a group of kids sitting around being friends instead of him being the bully and them being the kids that he had to go and apologize to. But that was a process.
Yeah, I
originally took him in to make him apologize to these kids.
Yeah.
And when I recognized that it was not going to happen, that there had to be a point where they were interested in him and he was interested in them, then that's where we started dialogues with the kids, where he would sit there and he wouldn't respond at all, and I would get them talking, and that really helped him to open up quite a bit.
And I love that example, because I know with my own kids, you know, and even in my own life, I mean, you know, as adults we do the same thing. I find that when someone's willing to open the dialogue, you know, be it the person who is the victim or the person who, you know, is now being told they need to, you know, be humbled to their choices to be the bully, or even the bystander, you know, and it's so hard as a bystander who's witnessing this to be the one who actually, like, intervenes, because most bystanders don't, they just don't want to be involved.
Right.
But I find that instead of punishing or, you know, continue labeling the kid, you know, or making them do something community service-wise to just, you know, atone for whatever they did, it seems like the communication's key. And it's sad, because I think of our society now, and I think that's one of our biggest problems, is we don't open that dialogue, we don't open communication channels, which is why I think we're seeing such a growth with bullying amongst our kids. Because even as adults, I mean, and I hate to say, I mean, trust me, obviously we use social media, I mean, we're on Blog Talk Radio, which is, you know, using technology. And technology is great, but I think in some ways it's hindered us as a society, because kids don't know how to talk anymore. They know how to text, they know how to email, they know how to get on, you know, do instant messaging through Facebook or, you know, or Twitter or whatever.
But Snapchat.
But the face-to-face dialogue, you know, actually having a full conversation without technology being involved, you know, other than maybe Skype, because you can see each other. You know, I think that, you know, that's probably one of the things that maybe we're not recognizing. I love the fact you just brought that up, because that's what I've seen. I notice that when I get upset or whatever, it's so easy to take what somebody says in a Twitter comment or even an email, and, you know, basically our perception tries to translate what just that regular, you know, text means. And it's so easy to add to and, you know, read between the lines and, you know, manipulate and whatever what the meaning really was.
Well, and now with emojis and the other forms of technological communication that we have, they are actually trying to make it so you can send messages with sarcasm implanted in the text, with some pictures that show attitudes or feelings. Instead of just teaching us to communicate like regular humans, now we're trying to take all of the emotion that comes from communication and we're sticking it into the texting version. We're trying to give the power to the machine instead of teaching that you talk and you understand and you listen to what someone else is trying to tell you.
Yeah, that's true. And
communication
I think
has been a big. Communication has been made a big difference with most of the situations that I've dealt with people who find themselves in a victim role or who find themselves in a bully role as well, mm-hmm. because this is the way they communicate. I'm going to cower and I'm going to pretend like you can't hurt me, or I'm going to threaten you and I'm going to get what I want. And when you make them sit down and be humans and talk to each other and see each other and deal with each other instead of this is a group of people I can get what I want from, or this is a big scary person that I don't ever have to see again, then they start to connect.
Yeah. I totally agree. I'm sad that Fonda get to join us today, Tracy, but honestly, you've given so much great information today. So,
I'm disappointed that we didn't get to talk to Fawn either. There's so many questions I would have liked to have asked her.
I know. I would have too, because what they're doing is such a great, thing between books. And I know that they're doing speaking, going out and speaking in schools and stuff like that. I mean, it's just such a great thing to see happen. But I thank you for taking the time and, staying on the show, even though our guest wasn't able to, and just kind of talk with me and share what we both have, taken from when we, did go, talk to, Hear My Heart books and do the research on them and what they're doing. Cause that's what our Family Matters specials are all about, right? Is to help.
Yeah, that's right. Anything we can do. Anything we can do to help families to understand and do a good job with their kids. Their kids are our future.
Yes, they are. Well, thank you, Tracy. And I know you do blogging. Have you been, I know you do author interviews and book reviews and stuff. Would you like to share your blog with people so they can kind of keep in touch and follow with what you're doing? Because I know anytime you come across something that you feel is, good for someone who wants to get into writing or just in general, that you think people would be interested in, you put up. So I would love for people to be able to follow you on your blog.
Yeah, I have two separate blogs. I have a blog where I share what I've learned about writing in the last 4 or 5 years that I've been writing, what I've learned from other writers, what I learned about publishing. I'm starting a series in August where we will go through the 7 basic archetypes of plot lines and how you can use those 7 basic archetypes of plot lines to market your books. Because everybody at some point in their life is going through one of those 7 basic archetypes. And if you market to a person who's going through that basic archetype, then a lot of times your book will be exactly what they're looking for at that period of time. So that will be a series that lasts 7 months. That's www.tracymcdonald, Tracy with an I, T-R-A-C-I, the blind lady with an extra I, McDonald, like in Golden Arches, mcdonald.blogspot.com. And then I also have another blog that I do, thmcdonald, thmcdonald, at blogspot.com, which is, it goes into a little bit more of what I do as a blind person, as a mother, as a believer in Christ, that kind of thing. And it's more about my day-to-day experiences. What I do with my kids, what I learned from my stupid falling down and almost getting run over by cars and all the crazy things that I go through. And that one is called A Few Steps Into the Darkness. And that one's a little more personal. That one gets to know me as an author a little bit better and me as a person a little bit better. But you can find me on Facebook as well, TracyMcDonald.505. And I post all of my my blogs on my Facebook page.
Yeah, you are. You're very good about that. You're way better than I am. I'm so terrible. I see better about social
media. Well,
blogging
is something that I really, really enjoy. It's a lot of fun for me. I like doing it. I post every Tuesday and every Wednesday, unless I have some kind of dramatic medical thing going on with me. So you can always find me Tuesdays and Wednesdays on my blogs.
Well, I thank you, Tracy. I thank you for being, on the show as one of the hosts and, sharing your personal experiences as well. Because it's one thing when you have a guest and the guest is talking about it, but, to actually open up and share ourselves, from from here at World of Ink Network, our own personal experiences, it does take a lot. But I know you're very open. you're so good about that. It's one of the things we love about you here. So, but we want to thank our listeners for tuning in as well. Definitely tune in August 4th for Marcia's show that she has coming up. And then, because that'll be our next one. And then if you want to know anything else about the World of Ink Network, our hosts, the shows we do, authors that we've had on, you just go to worldofinknetwork.com, or you can go to worldofinknetwork.blogspot.com. And then, of course, it's World of Ink Network at Facebook. You can find us there. And in Twitter, it's just World of Ink. And you can follow what we're going and doing and what upcoming shows we have as well and past shows and that kind of information. We thank everybody for listening. We hope you guys all have a safe week and enjoy the rest of the summer because school's right around the corner. So we'll be probably doing a back-to-school show in September because more people start in September, even though we start in August. And take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Virginia.
You're welcome.
Follow me to the World of Ink.